The Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today we will be talking to Laura McDonald as part of our mini-series on green jobs. Today's episode is hosted by James Myers. Dr. Laura McDonald is the Managing Director of the Mortensen Center in Global Engineering and Resilience and the Global Engineering Residential Academic Program. She holds a PhD in Geography and Environmental Engineering from the Johns Hopkins University and a BS in Environmental Engineering from Northwestern University. In her role as Managing Director, Laura manages the Mortensen Center's large-scale research program in Rwanda and provides support to the center's broader research portfolio in sub-Saharan Africa and the Western U.S. Laura also provides administrative programming and financial oversight of the Climate Innovation Collaboratory and the Mortensen Center's graduate and undergraduate education programs. Prior to joining the Mortensen Center, Laura was Knowledge and Research Advisor at the Center for Affordable Water and Sanitation Technology. There, she worked to build the center's reputation and credibility as a global leader in capacity development and technical support for non-networked water and sanitation. During her time at the Center for Affordable Water and Sanitation Technology, Johns Hopkins, and Northwestern, Laura's research spanned a range of topics, including household water treatment and water vending kiosks in Ghana, capacity development of sanitation practitioners, and the geochemistry of arsenic in the Atacama Desert. This work took her to Panama, Colombia, Chile, Ghana, Kenya, and Nepal. Throughout her studies, Laura was engaged with student groups focused on engineering and environmental education and outreach, including leadership roles in the Society of Women Engineers and Engineers for a Sustainable World. Well, welcome to the podcast, Laura. It's great to meet you and certainly interested in learning about your background and what you do with the Mortensen Center. Tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are and the type of work that you do helping people across the world.
Thanks, James. Thanks for having me. It's great to have an opportunity to talk to you and to share more about my work in the Mortensen Center. So I am an environmental engineer by training, and the way I followed that path to where I am today is I was interested in math and science as a child and pretty passionate about the environment and the outdoors. And so when considering my options when going to college, it seemed pretty obvious to me to pursue engineering as a way to do more applied science. My parents had a background in research science, and I knew I wasn't interested in that, but still wanted to contribute to society. And at that point, I started with a passion of protecting the environment. And so that's why I went into environmental engineering. But through my studies, I realized how intertwined humans are with the environment. And I got involved with Engineers for a Sustainable World, which is a lot like Engineers Without Borders, but just at different universities. And there I got exposure to thinking about engineering in low resource contexts, specifically in Panama. And I realized pretty quickly how heavily the human aspect of technical problems influences their success. And so from there, I went from being solely focused on environmental engineering to pursuing a PhD in human geography and environmental engineering. And in my studies there, I looked more at how to support effective policy to provide safe drinking water in Ghana. And so I went from thinking about a domestic context and protecting the environment to realizing that environmental engineering was a lot about, you know, providing safe drinking water and sanitation to people. And in the US, we have centralized means to do that and large scale infrastructure to do that. But in many low and middle income countries, it's decentralized. And so many communities and households don't have access to safe drinking water or sanitation. So my research then was how can policy support effective provision of these really critical services? And after that, I went to work for a nonprofit that was focused on supporting organizations by providing consulting and technical expertise to organizations around the world that were working to provide these services. But something that was an issue with me there was that many of these organizations were working outside of the government. And that was often ultimately to the detriment of what I believe is the duty of the government to provide these critical services to its citizens. And so unintentionally so, these well-intentioned organizations were undermining the role and responsibility of the government. And I hadn't figured out a solution to that, but it was just something that was starting to be in my mind and present. And so when I had the opportunity to join the Mortenson Center, it gave me a chance to kind of go back to education and more technical research instead of like consulting support. And so I was excited to be able to start to do some research to think about how to more effectively work within government systems and support government systems and generate evidence that can support a shift back to thinking of how outside of the United States that can be done. Because here in the United States, we're heavily reliant on our government to subsidize those services. So even in Boulder, you know, one of the wealthiest cities in the US, we only pay 60% of the true cost of our drinking water. And so that's something that's often forgotten when we think about supporting people who don't have these services. It's often, well, you need to pay for it. We'll get you started, but ultimately you have to pay the full cost. And it's like, well, no, if we think about how to work within and with the government, ultimately it should be able to provide this service at a subsidized cost. So some people will still have to pay, but not a full cost. And, you know, there are many other complexities of why governments aren't able to provide that service. But as an engineer, I thought it was my duty to make sure we weren't undermining the government's work towards that. And so, yes, at the Mortenson Center, I now do both research and education. And our research is focused on looking at the impact and effectiveness of interventions to support communities to be resilient to climate change impacts. Of course, that doesn't necessarily involve us doing the intervention part. And so that's always a tension of finding and working with partners that we feel provide high quality services, but knowing that we have to be hands-off in that side of it. We're just looking at the impact and not taking part in the intervention itself. And then on the education side, we have undergraduate education and graduate education programs. And so for the undergraduate level, really our objective is to expose as many incoming engineers as possible to the global context and the history of international development and the impact that climate change is having on communities around the world and how they as engineers can contribute to addressing those challenges and problems, even if their career isn't going to be focused on that. But by giving them that global perspective and making them aware of what's happening, not just at home, but around the world, how that can kind of broaden and expand how they think about the problems that they're solving. And then at the graduate level, it is students who've gone through undergraduate engineering and then know they want to get some level of depth in this. And so then we kind of go deeper and look at building more both technical and non-technical skills around addressing those challenges instead of just being aware of them and having them influence their perspective on the world. How can we give them a skill set to actually start to not address the symptoms of poverty, but start to get to the root causes?
That's really interesting. And you touch on many different areas, you know, in terms of talking about the effects of climate change, for example, needing to keep up on that, because I'm sure it's a very rapidly changing area and many probably differing perspectives on it.
Yes.
And so when you're looking for partners, so you mentioned that you partner with different types of organizations. What are the main focus of the organizations that you're partnering with, and how has that changed over recent times?
Yes. So the majority of our partners are focused on water and sanitation. And I'd say most of our work is currently focused in the Horn of Africa. So in East Africa, mostly Kenya and Ethiopia and Rwanda. That is my background. And also Evan Thomas, who's the director of the Mortenson Center, his expertise is also in water and sanitation. But what we've realized is the skill set we have for evaluating the impacts of water and sanitation interventions can be applied to other interventions. And so we've recently been expanding our work into the area that's called implementation science. And that's a way to do research with partners so that you can still have the quality of evidence that's expected of research institutions, but it can be iterative so that we're able to provide information to the implementer over time so that they're not operating in a vacuum while we're conducting our study and only find out the results 5 years later. And so that's been really valuable with one of our newest partners who's building trail bridges in Rwanda. And that intervention is intended to address the loss of access when flooding occurs, which is happening increasingly often in Rwanda, which is where we're focused. And so with that intervention, their theory of change is that if you provide consistent access to schools, health clinics, markets, external jobs, you'll see an improvement in livelihood, income, you know, a really wide range of outcomes. And so that's kind of a new area that we're looking at of rural infrastructure and other approaches to supporting communities, not to avoid the impacts of climate change, but to be better able to continue to thrive in the face of climate change. And so from water and sanitation to a different kind of infrastructure to thinking more broadly how the research that we do can be applied to any intervention that's focused on kind of that resilience to climate change and improving health and well-being.
And you mentioned Evan and his work in Rwanda, which is how we first found out about your mission. And I'm wondering maybe, you know, either through his experience or through your experience generally, if you can just tell us a little bit about both how you measure the success of your work and also how you involve the local communities in your work and local knowledge in your work, you know, specifically as we're looking at, you know, building a knowledge base and interest among young people, is there involvement of young people in your projects?
Mm-hmm. So success is always a tricky one to measure and define. Just first, you have to figure out what you mean by success. You know, at the highest level, our success is to be able to successfully run a study and generate high quality evidence that can then be analyzed. Of course, the interventions that we take on to study, we hope will be effective. But again, it's not our job to make sure that they are. So, you know, we are personally happy when the interventions are effective and our study finds that. But professionally, we define success by, you know, the quality of evidence that we generate. And then also, we really emphasize when we publish our findings to do so in open source journals, because we don't think it's successful if we just publish these papers and they're only accessible to scientists at universities that have access to journals that are very expensive. So we always budget in our research to be able to pay to have our journals be open source. So all of the students and teachers listening can access all of our publications because we've paid up front to make sure that the knowledge is more widely shared. With respect to local involvement and the involvement of young people, again, it's a bit tricky since we are not doing the intervention ourselves. But for example, Bridges to Prosperity, which is the organization that's building the trail bridges in Rwanda and other places around the world, they have a memorandum of understanding with the Rwandan government. And so they're putting in part of the funding and the Rwandan government is putting in part of the funding. And then almost all of B2P's employees are in the Rwanda office are Rwandan. At a higher level, they're also moving to employ East Africans specifically because of their focus in Uganda, Rwanda, and Ethiopia at those upper levels of their organization. And so not only are they working with the governments in the countries that they work with, they're also hiring people into positions of power and decision-making that are representative of the places in which they work. And that's a really important shift that I'm seeing throughout the international development sector. And it's one that's not easy, but one that I really admire and respect. With respect to the work that we are doing in Rwanda, our entire team conducting the research there are Rwandan. And so many of them have bachelor's or master's degrees. We have a team of about 60 people there. who are conducting the household surveys, conducting the market price surveys. We're doing monthly phone follow-up surveys. And then in the leadership there as well, they're all Rwandan. And so it depends on your definition of young, but we have early career young professionals collecting the data and managing the project. And then recently we've started to engage with the University for Global Health Equity, which was founded by Partners in Health, to try to identify ways to involve more students in Rwanda as well. And then a new project we're starting is working directly in schools in Rwanda to provide safe drinking water there. So there we have indirect interaction with school children, but again, because it's research, we have to protect the rights and privacy of students. So, you know, minimal engagement, but hopefully maximal positive impact. We don't want to have a distractive impact or an extractive impact of where we're benefiting from the work that we're doing and the students aren't. So that's something that isn't really the involvement of young people, but I wanted to highlight of as we think about how to engage people where we work, making sure it's to their benefit and not to ours.
Interesting, and certainly that extension of the mission by hiring people local who have knowledge of the region. And I guess once they're in place, then maybe they extend through their own networks as well. Exactly. In terms of the kind of skills that, of the people who are being hired for these projects by the local partners, is it primarily engineering, or does it involve other skills as well?
It's pretty wide ranging. So, you know, with British Prosperity, of course, they're hiring construction engineers as well as construction workers and laborers themselves. With ours, we see a pretty wide range of backgrounds from those who studied agricultural science to public health. I would say we don't even have that many engineers in our data collection team. They do come mostly from sciences, but it's pretty wide ranging. And it's important for them to have that science background in some ways, but really their most important skill is the ability to talk to people and get people to continue to talk to them when they come back once a year and people are tired of answering questions. So it depends on the level at which each individual is engaged in the study, whether they need technical skills or more social and interpersonal. But we're also working to start to provide professional development opportunities for those enumerators to be able to learn more, not just about our study, but from our network of professionals as well and other research that's going on in Rwanda and elsewhere.
I wanted to ask about technology because it's in our lives increasingly all the time. And in terms of the types of technology that you're engaging with in these projects and through the partners and the kind of technological skills that are in need, and in terms of young people thinking of career paths in this sort of area, what technologies are turning out to be most helpful? Is there any disruptive technologies coming down the line, you know, particularly with clean water and sanitation, but any other just general technological circumstances that that we should think about?
Well, this doesn't quite answer the question the way that you want it to, but the most disruptive technology I've seen in the last 10 years has been the smartphone with respect to data collection. And so I'm sure many of our listeners today have the ability to use a smartphone, but that's really revolutionized the ability to collect high quality data and have it accessible nearly immediately to check on its quality and then to start to clean it and prepare it for analysis, but also to look over time to make sure that there are no irregularities and that there aren't issues that we need to address. With respect to kind of the broader work that we do, something I haven't mentioned is remote sensing. And that's an area of expertise of Evan and of the Mortensen Center more broadly because of the students that he brings in to do research on remote sensing. And that is the development of new sensing technologies, but also geospatial analysis to look at the data that's coming in from those sensors and then overlaying satellite data and rainfall and flood data to start to get the larger picture. So for example, with the Bridges to Prosperity work in Rwanda, we've installed essentially trail cameras to monitor bridge use. And so at a dozen bridges, we're monitoring bridge use, and we can use video analysis and machine learning to identify when people are crossing and count bridge use. And then Dennis Mutike, who's actually just recently become Dr. Mutike, his job as the geospatial expert on our team was to overlay bridge use and then that rainfall and flood gauge data to start to see whether or not we saw more bridge use during periods of rain or flooding or not. And then also he started to develop a model that could be predictive of rainfall and flooding. And so ultimately, once we have the results of the study, we'll be able to analyze whether rainfall and flood data not only influences bridge use, but also influences our outcomes of interest. But then another key part of that is we hope that there will be a relationship between bridge use and those impacts so that Bridges to Prosperity doesn't have to do a $3.5 million 5-year study to report on their impact. They can just say, this study found a 10% increase in bridge use led to a 15% increase in access to external jobs and, you know, a 20% increase in farm product income from sales of products at markets. But so to get back to the technology, I think at least in our research group, the most valuable technology currently is that ability to use remote sensors to be able to monitor impact from afar and report back at regular intervals on what we're seeing. That's a little less obvious in the bridge use example, but in Kenya and Ethiopia, we've installed sensors that monitor the extraction of water from deep boreholes in areas that are suffering from extreme drought. And so the desire for that research project is to be able to use machine learning to develop a way that can predict when a pump is going to fail before it does, and then share that information with the local government for them to be able to send someone to address the issue before people totally lose access to water, because deep boreholes are often, especially during the dry periods, the only source of water. So if that well breaks down, there's a loss of access to water. And so I think those sensors are pretty simple, but they were pretty revolutionary in the idea of being able to use. At first it was cellular signal, but now it's satellite to be able to, and then a solar panel to be able to have these independently powered and then sending the information back to us to be able to develop a portal that the local government could see, and it would generate tickets for repairs. And so I think that's kind of the most exciting and disruptive technology with respect to technology development that our research group is involved in.
That's fascinating. And to think, you know, that the data could be as simple as, you know, being gathered using a smartphone. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to maybe just explore briefly what happens with this data. As you mentioned, you know, it's, you're using it, I guess, to inform the local authorities. You mentioned earlier, I think, some issues in terms of government control of these resources or oversight of these resources, I guess. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I think, cost, you mentioned access issues, you mentioned evidence. I'm just wondering, is there, you know, a general category of issues that you face in terms of getting the attention of local governance, or is it the way that the message is given to the local authorities that that really causes a change in their approach?
So I think the challenge that we've continued to face is really funding availability. So it's not a lack of interest or desire to address the challenge at the local level within the local government, but the mobilization of funding to fix the pump when it's known that it's an issue. So that's kind of where the breakdown in the system still is. And So that's actually why we're now working to pull in carbon financing to be able to generate a consistent revenue stream for ongoing operation and maintenance, because that's kind of the main failure point in water and sanitation provision in the context we work in. Is there might be funding for the first few years, but then because it's not really a revenue generating activity, and nor do I believe it should be, you know, there's not ongoing funding after that initial grant from a foreign government. And then there's also not the ability of the citizens in these remote areas with many challenges to pay a really high cost to be able to have that ongoing revenue. And so with carbon financing, there are ways in the existing carbon financing mechanisms to generate carbon credits from the provision of safe drinking water. And so through that, the idea is there can be that ongoing revenue from the sales of carbon credits to address that break in the chain. So that got away from your question, but I think it's less on the local government and their interest and ability, and more on just the availability of funds.
That's really interesting. And I wasn't aware that you could get carbon credits for safe drinking water. That's really interesting to, I'd like to learn more about that. Actually, it's interesting to know. And certainly, yeah, I mean, funding, I think is, I mean, it just has to be the top issue, I can imagine, and climate change and sustainability objectives across the world. So I wanted to maybe just explore too the work that the Mortensen Center does in kind of, you know, developing engineering skills, both in the US and internationally, and in mentoring young people as well. And if you can maybe just talk a little bit about your own experience, like, did you have a mentor in your own path to this career, and you know, how does that relate to the kind of mentoring that the center does for the engineers that it's developing?
Yes, so I would say I've never had a formal mentor, perhaps to my detriment, but when I look back at the path that I've taken, there are individuals that do stand out throughout, and the first was my undergraduate advisor, Aaron Packman, at Northwestern University, in that he brought me on to do research and trusted me to go to the Atacama Desert in northern Chile and collect water samples to look at the naturally occurring arsenic there and think about the impact on the local citizens, but I was looking at it from a geochemical perspective. So that was more basic science. I wasn't fixing the problem, I was defining it. But Aaron had a lot of faith in me and really helped me to develop my skills in research and in the lab. And then in grad school, I started going to a conference at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, pretty much every year. And there I met some really awesome women who I admired and looked up to and was happy to see every year. And it took me a really long time to finish my PhD. And ultimately it was one of those women, Danielle Lantain at Tufts University. I saw her one year in October and I told her that by the next time I saw her the next October, I would have defended. And so when I was scheduling my defense for the following year, I knew it had to be before that conference, so I could tell Danielle that I had finished. And then there are two other women, Susan Davis and Laura Brunson, who I would see at those conferences. And I always thought, that, man, they're so cool and so successful. And now I'm friends with them. And now I am that woman at the conference because I still go. I find value in it and find value in opportunities to connect with students and young professionals now. And my form of mentorship at that kind of strength of weak ties level is keeping all the people I meet at conferences in mind when job opportunities come across my desk, and knowing enough about those individuals to say, oh, this job, I should send this to Kelly because it seems like a great fit for Kelly. And then at the more higher touch mentorship level, I really enjoy doing that here at the Mortensen Center with our graduate students. who are pursuing the graduate certificate or the professional master's program by whether that's them working directly with me on research, or I oversee some students who do hourly work with us. And then also undergraduates for our Global Engineering Residential Academic Program. I have two undergraduate student assistants who help me with the extracurricular programming. And one of them is now going on to our professional master's program, and I'm really proud of her and excited for her. And also thankful that she gets to stay in my orbit for a couple more years before she leaves the nest. So yeah, I'd say those are the kinds of mentorship I do, that kind of low touch, strength of weak ties mentorship, to the high touch individual level, you know, weekly engagement. But then I also learn from those students. You know, one of those students, Emily Bedell, who's now going on to work at the EPA, is the one who introduced us to a book that kind of revolutionized our approach to global engineering education, called The Divide by Jason Hickel. And it's a really honest look at the history of international development and its ties with the history of colonialism and how it's actually quite extractive. And that's really changed our approach to education, but also our approach to research. And so, you know, selfishly as a mentor, I benefit from learning from my mentees, because they're often more aware of what's coming and what's new. So I think that's important for me as well, to make sure I'm staying hip to what's happening.
And that's a really interesting thing about the Mortensen Center, is the approach to not just, you know, training engineers and the skills that are needed on the ground, but also in the context, I think, is, you know, the causes of these problems. And so it's not just going in and dealing with the symptom, but hopefully, you know, dealing with the root problem. And that was that really struck me when I was looking into, you know, the work that you do. And I wanted to ask maybe just about the kind of numbers of students that have gone through the center's programs to date, both graduate and undergraduate, and also about the new online certificate that you have, which, you know, maybe would be more accessible to people not physically located in the U.S.
Yeah, those are good questions. So at the graduate level, our program has existed in some form since 2006. You know, Evan and I came in fall 2018. So based on the records we have available, we've had about just under 200 students go through either our graduate certificate or our professional master's programs. And so those students are now kind of working all over the world in conventional engineering consulting or construction firms, to working for the U.S. Agency for International Development or the World Bank, to working for nonprofits like IDE and Bridges to Prosperity. At the undergraduate level, we took on the Global Engineering Residential Academic Program in August of 2020, which is an interesting time to take over an undergraduate residential program. And each year, we average about 100 students who come into that program. And that's a first year engagement with the ability of students, depending on their interest, to then pursue the global engineering minor, because our required course for that program is also the starting point for the minor. And then with the online certificate, we just launched that last year. So we're currently recruiting students for the second cohort. Our first cohort was intentionally small. It was 5 students from, let's see if I'll remember all the countries, probably not, Nepal, Turkey, Rwanda, Kenya, and Ghana.
Wow.
And to us, that was a huge success, because as you pointed out, it's much more accessible as an online certificate to be able to engage in it wherever you are around the world. And that was the goal of developing the online certificate, was to make this education available more broadly and specific to people in places that we work, and people who, you know, don't have the ability to relocate to Boulder for a couple of years and, you know, pay to live in Boulder. nor do they necessarily want to come live in Boulder, right? It's not always a desire. And so the idea of the certificate is we changed the requirements. So you just have to have a bachelor's degree in any relevant field. And, you know, we take that as a case by case basis. And then other than that, you have to have some English language skills that can be proven by Duolingo at this point as well. And those are really the basic requirements. And then our objective is to recruit both students from the US and from around the world. And many students who would come from the US would be working for large companies that have education funding support. And so because of how the revenue comes to us, we would have the ability to essentially use the funding from domestic students and their company support to subsidize the costs for students around the world, to significantly lower the cost, if not eliminate it, and make it even more accessible, right? To lower that barrier to entry with respect to cost.
That's great. And actually, I realized we didn't define what environmental engineering encompasses. And so I thought maybe I should ask about that here too, for those interested in pursuing one of your programs.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So environmental engineering is a pretty broad topic. You know, in our area of focus, it is focused mostly on water treatment and wastewater treatment, or fecal sludge treatment in instances where they're latrines and not connected to water, but also looking at how to address sources of contamination that affect drinking water quality before it gets to the point of use. And environmental engineering is what many of our students come through with respect to our in-person graduate students. But our objective, both in our in-person work and more broadly, is to draw all different types of engineers and even non-engineers. So Evan's background is actually in aerospace engineering. And so he got into water treatment because he was looking at how to provide safe drinking water on the International Space Station, which is a challenge because it's really expensive to bring water up. So you got to basically just constantly reuse it. But then it's also that aerospace engineering expertise that allowed him to think about development of remote sensing and different types of sensors to have those innovations that we talked about earlier. And every year we have different kinds of engineering students. So mechanical engineering students who are often interested in thinking about like affordable prosthetics and the development and the use of mechanical engineering to design and produce affordable prosthetics in low resource contexts. And we have civil engineers looking more at that infrastructure side. So although many of our students are environmental engineers, I wanted to make it clear that when we talk about global engineering, we think really about how any kind of engineering can contribute. And we work to seek out opportunities for all those different engineers. For example, right now our lab could really use an electrical engineer because that's kind of often the pain point in the development of the sensors, you know, and there's a lot of mechanical engineering in the sensor design as well.
Interesting. Yeah. Lots of opportunities. Lots of opportunities. I was actually just noticing your Engineering and Resilience Awards, and maybe if you could just tell us kind of what types of people are winning these awards and what criteria you use, how you measure that resilience and how they qualify for these awards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this year we had a mechanical engineer who's now an environmental engineer win the student award. And she developed a low cost sensor to look at fecal contamination in water in real time. Our two professional recipients, one was an expert in geospatial analysis and comes from the environmental science side. His background was actually in marine biology, and then he kind of did a career pivot into environmental science and analysis of like large data sets. But he also actively mentored and developed systems to support women in sciences and in environmental science in Kenya. And then the other was from a public health background focused on sanitation and fecal sludge management. And he was from Uganda, and he's now a professor, and so educating the next generation of students. So when we think about criteria, we define it pretty loosely because we're always pretty surprised each year by what individuals are doing. So, you know, one year there was someone who was focused on technology development for safe drinking water provision. And so that's kind of a technology level intervention. But then another year, there was a woman working more at the systems level in Ghana to provide safe sanitation. So, you know, they're still focused on public health. There is a lot of environmental engineering influence because water and sanitation is pretty central to us, but it's also pretty central to public health as well. And then, you know, we've gotten applicants from conservation science as well. None of them have been chosen yet, but thinking about that human-wildlife interface and the protection of lands, not only for the animals themselves, but to the benefit of human well-being. So it's pretty, every year it's pretty interesting to review the applicants and identify. I'd say, you know, the standout is, of course, they have some area of expertise that's relevant to us and are doing work that's relevant to us, but really going above and beyond to positively impact the community of scientists and researchers or whatever expertise they work in, and benefiting that work community and that work network. But then also, of course, with consideration of positive impacts for the communities in which they work as well.
And those are great examples and stories of that kind of human connection that you spoke about earlier, how everything mm-hmm. intertwines with a human story. And yeah, very, very motivational. And I guess, you know, in the sense that we each mentor each other, those sound like great mentorship mm-hmm. cases. So thanks for sharing those. And in terms of, you know, how things have developed in your own career and in the Morton Center, is there anything looking back on it where you would say, well, you know, it was a good effort, but we could have taken a different course more effectively? And just, mm-hmm. you know, how learning opportunities emerge from these experiences over time?
That's a great question. So I think one key learning that we've had and that the whole sector has had, and I hinted at earlier, is the challenge that we faced with COVID. You know, international development is pretty heavily reliant on travel, and that was shut down for quite a long time. And it forced a rethink and a realization that maybe me as a Western engineer, maybe I'm not needed, you know, every 6 months somewhere. How can we work with our colleagues in the places in which we were traveling to better support them to do the work that they're fully equipped to do? And so I think there have been successes and failures there on a, you know, a personal and professional level, all the way up to how the Mortensen Center does things. But I think Evan and I are really excited by being forced to rethink that. And we don't yet have a solution, but we're also, you know, helping our students to better think about their role and what jobs not only are they best suited for, but can they best contribute to without undermining and taking away opportunities from professionals working in the context in which we work. And so that's required a rework of our approach to teaching, but also supporting students to get jobs afterwards. And so I define that currently as a success in progress. And, you know, it has definitely affected students' jobs when they leave. But I, you know, they're all still able to get jobs. They just might look a bit different than they anticipated. And so I think that's a challenge that we're still working through. Looking back on my history, the biggest failure that affected my path was when I was working with Engineers for a Sustainable World on two projects in Panama. And one of the projects was really working closely with a community, and, you know, they were leading the way and helping with implementation and planning for the future of that project. And it was, you know, small scale installation of solar panels on a school to provide electricity at night and a means to charge phones and other batteries. But then the other project we were doing was looking at providing wastewater treatment in a larger coastal town. And in that town, you know, we didn't have a lot of engagement with the local community. And they were pretty fed up with a bunch of undergraduates from the US coming once a year to do some tests and look at what was wrong and then disappear again. And that was when I realized that, yeah, definitely also as an undergraduate, maybe I shouldn't be designing a wastewater treatment facility. You know, I only at that time had a high school degree. But also that failure in ensuring that it was locally led and that there was buy-in. So, I mean, there were many challenges there. And Evan and I, we both kind of come from that background. Evan went through Engineers Without Borders. I went through Engineers for Sustainable World. But at least in the past, that was very project focused and more focused on student opportunity with the idea that it would benefit the communities in which we work. But not always, you know, it can, with students, it's a high turnover because we're only there for 4 years and often only involved in those programs for two. And you can only go on breaks. And so it's just at risk of being extractive. And so I think that was kind of an aha moment for me and a failure, at least for that community of Portobello, but something that I've tried to carry forward and led me to think about the interaction of people with technical problems and also be a bit more aware of the context in which we're working in the historical context.
Yeah, I definitely see that in Mortenson Center's mission that the context is very important, and certainly to the extent that you're involving local people with local knowledge, I guess you're getting the buy-in of them as well in mm-hmm. potential solutions. Is there any really innovative solution that you've found that you've been really proud of?
Because in my role, I'm more on the project management side versus technology solution development. I think I'm most proud currently of the study that we're running in Rwanda with British Prosperity and the ability to navigate a pretty complex set of criteria and plans with British Prosperity and constructing the bridges, but also with our, you know, our team of 60 who are surveying 16,000 households a year and 2,000 households a month and 2,000 market vendors a month. You know, it's a pretty complex system to manage. And I think also the relationship with British Prosperity as the implementation partner has been really successful. And because we designed that study to be able to work without negatively impacting their ability to construct those bridges, you know, we haven't said, okay, you have to wait and then you have to build all of these bridges within 1 year so we can study them afterwards. You know, the innovation there was thinking of how to design the study so that they could build bridges over time, but we could still get the high quality evidence we needed for pre and post construction to look at impact. So that's not a sexy technology innovation, but it is a research innovation that we think can be carried forward to other places and make it possible to study interventions in a way that's as unintrusive as possible and doesn't get in the way of the positive impact that we hypothesize those interventions are having.
So it's a really like a real-time research. You're staying on top of it on a real-time basis. And mm-hmm. I guess you're able then to adjust any processes in the course of it that might need adjusting or, you know, could benefit the project, I guess, as you're doing the real-time research. That's really interesting and very impressive to hear the extent of that project. I didn't ask actually earlier, it's a project, I assume, where they are building bridges to allow for people to, I think you mentioned access, you know, services. Mm-hmm. These are bridges over waterways.
They are bridges over areas that flood during rains. Right. So sometimes there are, you know, small rivers that always are there. But the main issue is when the rains come, the areas flood and make it unsafe to cross. And some people do still try to cross, or there are basic bridges that have been built that aren't necessarily safe. So the objective is to avoid death while trying to cross, but really to avoid loss of access to all those critical services and income generating activities over time.
And I imagine the flooding, probably like everywhere, is becoming more extreme these days.
Exactly. Wetter places are getting wetter.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I so appreciate your time here. I think my last question is just in terms of your own view of sustainability and whether you have a sustainability hero, you know, somebody that you just really, not necessarily somebody that you know personally, although it could be, but just, you know, who, what kind of person or what kind of work does really inspire you and, you know, might inspire some of the people listening to this podcast?
Yeah, I love that question. So I was a painfully practical child, and I never really dreamed big or had large heroes. I think it was kind of everyday people who inspired me. But right now, you know, my sustainability hero is my friend's daughter, Frankie, who has really just like taken on learning about sustainability and incorporating it into her life and educating her peers. You know, she recently found out or learned about Wangari Maathai, who is a Kenyan woman who won the Nobel Peace Prize. And she was outraged that, you know, she had known about Greta Thunberg for so long, and but hadn't known about this incredible Kenyan woman. And so she also has the awareness to call out racism and think about the impact and interwoven aspects of racism in the efforts around sustainability and how we define and approach sustainability. You know, she's contacted local officials and just is really doing her best to learn more and to educate others. And that's really what gives me hope in the area of sustainability, not to put the burden on young people to save our world, but the passion and the engagement and the efforts to change not just her peers, but the community and the systems in which she lives. And at such a young age, I really find that inspiring.
It's amazing. How old is Frankie?
Oh, I think Frankie is 10.
Wow. That's a great story.
Sorry if I got that wrong, Frankie.
Well, that's a great story. I mean, it's somebody that young could be a hero. In terms of, you know, in any kind of last advice that you might have for young people listening to this, how they can find their own sustainability heroes or mentors or to become a sustainability hero, is there any kind of advice, you know, that you could offer to a young person just on a general basis?
Yeah, I think what I still struggle with, but what I think is important to keep in mind is we do have an individual responsibility to make decisions around sustainability and minimize our impact. But that's really what the people in power want us to think, that it's our responsibility and our problem, and not to be distracted by guilt around your impact, and instead use that energy to think about how you can use your voice to influence your local and national government officials, influence the companies that you buy from, and really speak out for change at that level. Because, you know, even if we all try to stop eating meat, there will be other people around the world who don't. And not that one has to stop eating meat to be sustainable. It's just an example. I know that there has been an intentional effort to distract us from the systemic sustainability problems by making it a personal problem. And so not only that, but, you know, guilt and worry and fear can eat you up and use the energy that you could instead use to advocate for change. And so I'd say to try to stay positive, but also to stay focused on those systems and your ability as a citizen to change those systems by using your voice, and not to waste your energy feeling bad about any negative impacts you're having.
That's great advice. And certainly, I guess, to the extent that we could hopefully connect more people like Frankie to other young people around the world, then that would be great motivation as well. So I thank you very much for this discussion. It's been so great and so wonderful hearing about the work that you do in inspiring all of these great partnerships, you know, around the world. I'd like to think that, you know, local people could reach out to maybe some of these partner organizations and see if there's any way that they can get involved, maybe as a way of exploring local opportunities.
Definitely. We welcome that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely be interested in following your program and seeing how it evolves. You know, I think especially with the online opportunity, I think could be great for people who don't have the means to be present in person, but are still very interested mm-hmm. in pursuing environmental engineering.
That's our hope. Yeah. Yes. Thanks so much, James.
Well, thank you, Laura. And it's been great talking to you, and we'll look forward to hearing more. This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Laura McDonald. Episode hosted by James Myers. Organized by James Myers. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org and join our online community at tsl.earth. Thank you for listening.